His reputation, like the lust for Stetsons and high-heeled boots, started at the state line, and he made the most of it by plastering the front of the Jersey Lily with signs, ice-cold beer and law west of the Pecos, and placing himself on display in a rocking chair on the porch at train time. Earlier, he'd bribed conductors and porters to prime passengers for the big attraction, but the railroad men were willing enough to spread the stories free of charge, so eventually he returned his poke to his pocket. Roy was scrupulous when it came to his own money. Pilgrims who witnessed this exhibition of living waxworks noted that physically the man matched his legend and assumed he was born fully fleshed out in his seventh decade, with his belly spilling through the banker's waistcoat, buttoned only at the top, tumbleweed whiskers, and eyes that glistened like damp plums under a sombrero with a buggy wheel brim. But in his youth, he was a frontier Apollo, tall and raw-boned, with a bristling black beard, a landlocked pirate prince who shot a man in San Diego, California, over an affair of the heart and spent his period of incarceration accumulating poundage from a steady supply of cold chicken and enchiladas smuggled into his cell by pretty señoritas of the old Pueblo. In Roy Bean's universe, a pirate was never anything less than a prince, and señoritas were invariably pretty. Was this man, loose-gutted and musty-smelling, the lean young panther who'd crouched behind bars, fastidiously licking grease from his fingers and grinning at the giggling spectators outside? "I have an old injury from a fall from my horse while serving with the U.S. Cavalry during the battle for Mexico City," he wrote Lily Langtree many years later, by way of one of his literate children. "The pettifoggers in Washington have held up my pension, but there is one less Spanish despot walking the earth for my effort, and that's sufficient reward." He was anticipating a face-to-face meeting with the actress and the need to explain the stiff neck that had plagued him for nearly 50 years. The complaint was actually the result of a lynching that failed to take. He'd cultivated the facial hair, it was said, to mask the hemp scars. The circumstances were cloudy, but had something to do with the honor of a young woman. A pattern was forming. It happened, if it happened, in Los Angeles, California, more than 6 years after the ratification of the peace treaty between the United States and Mexico. He never defended the Union, and his subsequent attempt to bring it down at Glorieta was negligible. In the last year of the Mexican adventure, most accounts place Roy in Independence, Missouri, with his brother Sam, who had served with the American Expeditionary Force below the border, arranging to join a wagon train with the intention of establishing a trading post west of the Rockies. Roy was always an entrepreneur first, a colorful character second, and a man of justice only because he refused to relinquish possession of the only book on Texas statutes for 200 dusty miles. If, however, he could be said to have come by anything honestly, it was his interest in the disposition of the law. Another brother, Joshua, presided over primitive San Diego as alcalde, a post that settled disputes among natives and passed sentence for capital crimes such as the theft of a neighbor's sourdough starter. Josh, too, claimed service in Mexico, but no record ever surfaced.